Chapter 10. Sadly, many of President John F. Kennedy's accomplishments during his term in office are overshadowed by his assassination on November 22, 1963. When his name is mentioned, that cruel and calculated act is the first thing people think about, instead of the good JFK did while in office. There is even the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza, an outdated museum infected with distortions of history regarding his death, the only one in existence since there is none regarding the assassinations of Presidents Abraham Lincoln, William McKinley, or James Garfield. More about that museum, nothing but a cash cow, a disturbing shrine to Lee Harvey Oswald that deceives students, teachers, and the general public regarding the truth about what happened there in 1963 and should be closed, is chronicled in this book's epilogue. Unfortunately, the fixation on JFK's death is similar to how many people think about Marilyn Monroe, and even, to some extent, Dorothy Kilgallen. Why? Because instead of focusing on the wonderful entertainer side of Marilyn or the amazing journalistic or television part of Kilgallen's life, the immediate thought when their names are mentioned is to recall that both allegedly had drug problems leading to their respective deaths. Regarding Marilyn, the claim has some merit, leading to the belief she committed suicide, despite the fact, as her friend Pat Newcomb stated, that the night before she died, she was in a good mood, a very happy mood. As for Kilgallen, there is no evidence whatsoever that the claim is true. But rumors outweigh that truth, since the New York City Medical Examiner reported that her death, as will be explored, was due to an overdose of barbiturates. The intersection of Kilgallen's life and times and her demise with JFK happens on many levels. For instance, on January 20, 1961, 4+ years prior to her death, she covered his inauguration ceremonies. Her means of transportation signified her importance in the world. A silver Wraith Rolls-Royce driven by Roosevelt Zanders, a stout African-American chauffeur to such luminaries as Fidel Castro, John Wayne, and Nikita Khrushchev. Smiling ear to ear, Kilgallen sat in a position of respect as JFK took the oath of office, the fifth row beside columnist Bob Considine and a Life magazine representative with a clear view of the new president. After white-haired Robert Frost read his poem, The Gift Outright, JFK, coatless despite the cold weather, uttered his inspiring line, "And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Despite a blizzard threatening the five inaugural balls, Kilgallen attended the Rat Pack Gala, headlining Frank Sinatra and his celebrity pals. She and Frank did not acknowledge each other's presence for reasons to be explained. What many in the media called a new, youthful spirit to the White House, a fresh coat of paint, one wrote, a new place of hope, said another, was in line with JFK's desire to make the White House a place to celebrate American history, culture, and achievement. In the coming months and years, noted artists, writers, scientists, poets, musicians, actors, and athletes made their appearance. Jackie, who shared her husband's interest in American history, gathered some of the finest art and furniture the United States had produced, while restoring all the rooms in the White House to reflect America's history and artistic creativity. Photos were also scattered throughout the media showing the president's truly human side as he played with Caroline and John John. To ensure a childhood packed with the best a father could offer, a childhood much different in scope than Marilyn's, the Kennedy children were treated to preschool, a swimming pool, and a treehouse on the White House lawn. Despite being the most powerful man in the world, with a schedule that caused the back pain in his back to inflame on an hourly basis, the photos of the president's smile exposed a man at peace with himself and his surroundings. Love for Caroline was apparent, but it was John John who stole his heart. Even today, so many decades later, The famous photo of the youngster saluting during his father's funeral procession brings tears to bear. Time with the children permitted JFK to tolerate the problems he faced, including the potential of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The Cold War, as it was dubbed, brought increasingly predictable friction between communistic and democratic agendas. Distrust ran deep, and that distrust resulted in an unprecedented dangerous buildup of nuclear weapons. Real conflict with millions of lives at stake finally erupted with the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the same year Marilyn died, pitting the Kennedy brothers against Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet premier. In what may very well have been RFK's finest hour, he stood by his older brother's side and forced Khrushchev to blink first and remove Soviet nuclear missiles from Cuba, thus averting a catastrophe. If ending the threat of nuclear war with the Soviet Union is notable as a foreign policy success, JFK's handling of the Vietnam War crisis is instead viewed by many as a complete disaster. Kennedy had begun slowly escalating the American position in Southeast Asia in April 1961, when he approved Project Jungle Jim, which called for the United States Air Force advisors to train members of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, and Republic of Vietnam Air Force, RVNAF. In May 1961, Kennedy issued National Security Action Memorandum, NSAM 52, which officially committed the United States to preventing a communist takeover in Vietnam. 400 United States Army Special Forces advisors, also known as Green Berets, were dispatched to South Vietnam. This action would trigger escalations across the board, up to and including November 1963, when JFK's death ended his presidency. While battling with an unpopular and unnecessary war, which needlessly killed thousands of American soldiers, JFK continued to inspire by stating, "I am asking each of you to be new pioneers in that new frontier." To that end, one of the first things he did was to create the Peace Corps, permitting Americans to volunteer to work anywhere in the world by helping in areas such as education, farming, healthcare, and construction. This effort won the respect of people throughout the world. The exploration of space was another JFK priority. Realizing that the United States trailed the Soviet Union in all aspects of that endeavor, the president stated, "No nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space." He was the first president to ask Congress to approve more than $22 billion for space exploration in what became Project Apollo. It had the goal of landing an American man on the moon before the end of the decade. Kennedy was also determined to tackle the issue of racial discrimination, and what he achieved may be arguably his finest hour. Despite the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 1954 that segregation in public schools would no longer be permitted, that black and white children must go to school together, Kennedy knew there were many schools, especially in southern states, that did not obey this law. Racial segregation also continued in restaurants and movie theaters, on buses, and in other public places. Initially, JFK resisted getting involved despite thousands of Americans, people of all races and backgrounds, joining together to protest the injustice peacefully. Martin Luther King Jr. was front and center as one of the most dynamic leaders of the movement for civil rights, and he didn't believe the president was standing tall with him and other religious leaders. However, by June 11, 1963, months before his tragic death, JFK proposed a new civil rights bill to Congress and delivered a television address to the nation, stating in part, 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds, and on the principle that all men are created equal. From this important edict, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 would be passed into law. Although neither realized it at the time, one action stands out among all others in the role it played in destroying the lives of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the new president as well. In late 1960, Joseph Kennedy forced his son, the newly elected president, to appoint Brother Bobby Attorney General of the United States. This crucial decision, as noted in the introduction, was witnessed by Kennedy advisor John Siegenthaler. Marilyn's death happened less than 2 years later in early August 1962, and Kilgallen's close to 5 years later in November 1965. How may one connect Joe's demand/order that JFK appoint Bobby as Attorney General to all three deaths? Chronicling Joe's character, or lack thereof, and his determination at all costs, legal or not, to boost JFK into the White House provides the necessary proof. Joe Kennedy's forcing JFK to appoint Bobby Attorney General was no news to those who knew Joe as a strong advocate who got his way always. As exposed through the years by authors of several credible biographies, his past was packed with incidents where Joe played both sides of the law in order to amass a fortune and become one of the most elite power brokers in the world. Even author David Nassau, in his 2012 book The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy, a soft soap perspective of the elder Kennedy, written at the request of and authorized by Edward Kennedy and Jean Kennedy Smith, admits that Joe was alleged to be an appeaser, an isolationist, an anti-Semite, a Nazi sympathizer, an unprincipled womanizer, a treacherous and vengeful scoundrel who made millions as a bootlegger and Wall Street swindler, then used those millions to steal elections for his son. He adds that there is some truth to these allegations is indisputable, while noting they only tell part of a larger, grander, more complicated history. Complicated may have been Nassau's perception based on credible research, but others do not hesitate to condemn Joe Kennedy as the man forced to resign as U.S. Ambassador to England under President Franklin D. Roosevelt due to Joe's appeasing attitude toward Hitler and his isolationist position regarding U.S. involvement in World War II. Peter Collier and David Horowitz, authors of The Kennedys, An American Drama, wrote, "Rumors of numerous extramarital affairs, illicit business dealings, and even ties to crime only added a piquant touch of mystery to his reputation and made Joe seem all the more romantic, Gatsby-esque." Collier and Horowitz, who interviewed multiple sources close to the Kennedy family, then present a quote from a Fortune magazine article to make their point. "The legends of Joe Kennedy make him at once the hero of a Frank Merriwell Captain of the Nines adventure, a Horatio Alger success story, an E. Phillips Oppenheim tale of intrigue, and a John Dos Passos disillusioning report on the search for the big money." The article continued, "The truth makes him a central character of a picaresque novel of a sort not yet written. Joe was more than a ruthless opportunist, a characterization as relevant to RFK as to his father." Author C. David Heyman noted that as early as the days when Joe was about to marry Rose, her father sensed a moral defect in young Joe and initially opposed the marriage. Nassau also concluded that during the Great Depression, Joe was one of a consortium of profiteers who manipulated a given stock's price via calculated rumors and trading in order to become rich. Ronald Kessler quoted Joe as saying, after the stock market crash, that he was waiting to pick up the pieces left by dumb people. Perhaps even more distasteful, during this time the family patriarch purchased apartment buildings at low cost. Then he didn't hesitate to double rents, gouging the tenants without any concern for their welfare. To be certain, the narcissistic Joe Sr. was all about Joe Sr., just as ex-President Donald Trump was all about Donald Trump while in office, each suffering from a personality disorder, one that includes being untruthful, an excessive need for admiration since they were in love with their self-image, a basic lack of empathy for others, an inability to handle criticism, and a sense of entitlement and disregard for the rule of law. Due to this personality disorder, just as Joe Sr.'s actions amounting to abuse of power spilled over into violence, ultimately triggering JFK's assassination, the ex-president's abuse of power triggered violence as well. This happened when Trump incited thousands of his supporters-slash-insurgents to assault-slash-infiltrate the hallowed U.S. Capitol building, threatening the lives of America's lawmakers on January 6, 2021, and thus causing destruction of government property and violence resulting in the deaths of five people just days before he left office after losing the 2020 election. In effect, Joe Sr., like Donald Trump, and indeed RFK, possessed a grandiose image of himself with each of these powerful men in love with their inflated self-image, a mask that enabled them to avoid very deep feelings of insecurity by proving their self-worth through illicit means. Author Heyman noted that Joe Sr., a bootlegger during Prohibition and in business with racketeers such as New York's Frank Costello, had circumvented the law by importing thousands of cases of spirits under medicinal licenses before selling them for millions more than he paid for them. Perhaps more important, Heyman wrote, "Even more diligently than he accumulated great wealth, Joe poured into his sons everything he learned and wished for himself." This may be why author Seymour Hersh, in his book The Dark Side of Camelot, alleged that both Bobby and Ted Kennedy personally distributed bribes and other payoffs in West Virginia during the 1960 election, like father, like sons. Joe had been fixing elections back to his early days in Boston. Hersh wrote, "This had caused Evelyn Lincoln, President Kennedy's secretary, to admit, 'I know they bought the election,' a comment backed up by author Evan Thomas's allegations. Votes were sold in West Virginia and the Kennedys paid for them." Hersh also pegged Joe as a partner with the notorious Frank Costello during Prohibition, despite denials by the elder Kennedy. Hersh, known for his detailed accounts of the Kennedy family, wrote, "Joe Kennedy played by his own rules in running his personal life and in amassing his personal fortune. He employed the same ruthlessness and secrecy with all, his wife, fellow businessmen, organized crime figures, and political figures." Author Ted Schwartz, in his book Joseph P. Kennedy, The Mogul, The Mob, The Statesman, and The Making of an American Myth, wrote that none other than the revered Eleanor Roosevelt despised Joe Kennedy. She saw him as a man of few principles. In David E. Koskoff's excellent biography, Joseph P. Kennedy, A Life and Times, based on inside information from sources close to the Kennedy clan, he wrote about the patriarch's business acumen following the stock market crash of 1929. In the months that followed, Joe Kennedy was in the thick of some of the most unsavory trading in the history of American business. He unquestionably did considerable short selling, thus helping to aggravate and further depress the market, the American economy, and the psychological well-being of the nation. He showed a stealing disregard for the consequences of his actions to anyone but himself. He was about making money, and that's what counted. Years later, he would brag about this least praiseworthy period of his life. Revered author David Halberstam, who knew the Kennedys for decades, saw another side of Joe Kennedy, writing of his rage based on examples where the elder Kennedy lashed out at not only associates but family members as well. Author Ronald Kessler, through years of reliable research and primary sources, focused on a disturbing characteristic of the elder Kennedy, his anti-Semitism and lack of concern for the victims of Nazi oppression and what amounted to genocide with a vengeance never seen before. Among the quotes offered to back up this claim were those of Morton Downey Jr., a Kennedy family friend. According to Kessler, Downey said, "Joe Kennedy's feeling toward Jews was that the only way he could be a success was that every day when he got up, he would focus on one deal involving a Jew and he would win that deal. That was his whole driving spirit." Downey added, "Joe and his father would refer to Jews by a code word, Canadian geese, apparently because of a perception that Jews have long noses." Joe the Womanizer was the predecessor to JFK and RFK, the Womanizers, like father, like sons, carbon copies of their father, each suffering from sexual addiction, each intent on instant gratification without a care for the consequences. Among those whom Joe cheated with during his long marriage to Rose were, according to Ronald Kessler's excellent research, Claire Booth Luce, later a congresswoman from Connecticut and the wife of Henry Luce, a noted magazine publisher, sexy fashion models supplied to Joe by famous designer Oleg Cassini, Kay Stammers, a British tennis star, actress Marlena Dietrich, a friend of Dorothy Kilgallen's, and the woman Kessler called Joe's Hollywood trophy, glamorous starlet Gloria Swanson, the reigning queen of the movies, and Joe's girlfriend in the late 1920s, best known for playing beleaguered silent screen star Norma Desmond in the classic Sunset Boulevard. Marilyn Monroe became JFK's short-lived trophy mistress during his presidency, but it was Joe who had first enjoyed a clandestine sexual relationship with a famous Hollywood celebrity years earlier, despite being a husband and father. In fact, author Christopher Bigsby pointed out, through a quote from Hollywood cameraman Leon Shamroy, that Monroe had a kind of fantastic beauty, like Gloria Swanson, when a movie star had to look beautiful. Author David Nassau, who, as noted, was reluctant to criticize any Kennedy family member, admitted to the elder Kennedy's infidelity, writing, "Joe enjoyed the company of other women, hundreds of them over his lifetime, actresses, waitresses, secretaries, stenographers, caddies, models, stewardesses, and others." Regarding the Swanson affair, Nassau wrote, "Gloria Swanson offered him the vehicle he needed to climb to the top of his profession." The author then documents the first time Swanson and Joe had sex, January 1928, shortly before Joe and Rose Kennedy's fifth child was born. He then recounts their sexual trysts in Beverly Hills at Joe's rented house on Rodeo Drive. Said Swanson, "I must confess I was impressed with his sense of power, and the odd occurrence where Swanson, Rose, and her sister Margaret actually sailed together from Paris to New York." Said Nassau, "Swanson recalled for her memoir the near lunacy of sailing home with her lover and her lover's wife and sister, before finally commenting, "The inescapable truth was that for Joseph P. Kennedy, Swanson was another sexual conquest, one of many he would fit into his busy life, one he could flaunt even in front of his wife. That he wandered from the marriage bed was inconsequential to him. Adultery was a sin, but one easily forgotten." In his book RFK, author Heyman told of the Kennedy family's concern about Joe's sexual habits outside the marriage to Rose. Heyman wrote, "Joe had always been an ardent womanizer, but his dalliances became so embarrassing to both sides of his family that one day his father-in-law took him aside and advised him to be more discreet. Honey Fitz was incensed at the shame Joe's behavior was inflicting on Rose." Based on these disclosures, the saying, "the apple doesn't fall far from the tree," is certainly appropriate when it comes to discussing Joe, John, and yes, Robert Kennedy's love life. Each was an adulterer of the first degree, with John and Robert having had an excellent tutor in this regard. Ted Sorensen, arguably JFK's closest advisor, whose book, Counselor, A Life at the Edge of History, soft-pedaled Kennedy family flaws, wrote, "JFK was unfailingly flirtatious with all young women, particularly pretty single women, Like his father before him, JFK did not resist these temptations when they became available. While these characterizations, ones depicting moral decay across the board, shed light on the flawed man who poured into his sons everything he learned and wished for himself, Joseph Kennedy's 738-page FBI file, acquired by this author under the Freedom of Information Act, provided more information about who Joe was and how he was clearly a clever man who played on both sides of the street. Little known is the fact that as early as 1937, he was under scrutiny by the Bureau. Even less known is that Joe and future FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover became friends during a time when both interacted with the National Maritime Union. When Hoover was appointed head of the Bureau, this would lead to an obscure posting in Kennedy's FBI file indicating that in October 1944, Joe Kennedy was enlisted in this office, Boston, in the case entitled Bureau File Number 1-8039. The reference, based on further file notations, turned out to be Joe becoming a special service contact. 9 years later, a file memo commenting on Joe's qualifications to be appointed to the Commission on Governmental Reorganization noted, "The Bureau's relations with Kennedy over the past years have been very cordial." This apparently meant Joe could be helpful based on, as a November 1954 memo mentioned, his position as an outstanding financier and industrialist and being highly regarded in business, governmental, and professional circles. A previous memo in January 1954 called him a special services contact of the Boston Division for many years, one who was valued. The November memo noted that Joe was a close personal friend of the director and the Bureau. Whatever had attracted Hoover and Joe Kennedy to become close friends continued through the years, according to the FBI file. On October 30, 1959, Joe wrote to Edgar regarding what Joe referred to as a real masterpiece article, Communist Illusion and Democratic Reality. Joe liked the piece so much he suggested to his friend that son John might use excerpts in stump speeches to audiences who are completely sympathetic to your ideas but lack the imagination as to how to put them into effect. Hoover responded, "My thanks for your thoughtfulness and compliments." When John Kennedy won the White House, Hoover wrote a November 9, 1960 letter to the Honorable Joseph P. Kennedy, stating, "I do want to let you know how pleased I am with his election as President of the United States," while ending the letter with, "Warm personal regards, Edgar." After Joe died in 1969, Hoover sent a letter, the file noted, to Ted Kennedy with the final paragraph including the words, "I am grateful for the close friendship I shared with Joe over the years. I have lost a dear friend, and my thoughts are with you during this time of grief." Two file notations indicated how the clever Joe had ingratiated himself to the Bureau and to Hoover, with the first indicating how Joe was polishing the apple with Hoover, and the second how he lured son John into the same sort of lovely compliments. In March 1953, Joe wrote Hoover, "I want to tell you that I am very grateful to you. Again, it makes me feel how privileged we all are to have a man like yourself giving his life to the service of his country." Later, Joe met with Special Agent J.J. Kelly, but brought along JFK. Kelly later wrote to Hoover, "Senator Kennedy expressed to him, Joe, as believing the FBI to be the only real government agency worthy of its salt, and expressed his admiration for your accomplishments." In 2010, when the Edward Kennedy FBI files were released, Joe Kennedy's high admiration for Hoover was apparent throughout. The file divulged that Joe, in 1955, had written to Hoover saying, according to the FBI director, that he understood I, Hoover, was interested in becoming a candidate for the presidency, He urged me to run for this position, either on a Republican or Democratic ticket, guaranteeing me the largest campaign contribution I would ever get from anyone, and his personal services as the hardest campaign worker in history. Hoover declined the suggestion, but the file noted that he was deeply touched by the wonderful confidence implicit in his offer. When one considers how Joe waxed friendly with Hoover, one startling fact about his FBI file becomes less startling. There is not a single mention of Joe's adulterous affairs, his having committed adultery, or any secret relationships or activities with those connected to the underworld, despite apparent knowledge both of Joe's bootlegging enterprises and affection for underworld characters such as Frank Costello and, even more apparent, Sam Giancana. When one reads the file, Joe is squeaky clean, a saint of sorts, with absolutely no skirmish or scandal concerning any of his credentials or dealings. This despite author Seymour Hersh reporting that Cartha D. DeLoach, a deputy director under Hoover, had told him he knew Kennedy was a prominent bootlegger during Prohibition, and that he had associates in organized crime who respected him. Joseph Kennedy biographer Ronald Kessler included several references to Joe's bootlegging days in his book, The Sins of the Father, Joseph P. Kennedy and the Dynasty He Founded, leading to the author's conclusion that bootlegging on a sizable scale accounted for Joe's sudden and fabulous wealth. In a March 2013 Vanity Fair profile of former millionaire Hollywood producer Merv Adelson, he mentioned Las Vegas mobster Mo Dalitz while writing, "He was a rum runner. So was Jack Kennedy's father. In fact, Mo told me they were good friends." Adelson also divulges that one of his real estate projects, the Sunrise Hospital in Las Vegas, was financed through James Hoffa's Teamsters Union Pension Fund. "Were the Teamsters mobbed up?" Adelson asks. "Oh, God, were they." Joe Kennedy's links to mobsters provided the prelude to soliciting their help during the 1960 presidential election. Author Ted Schwartz wrote, "As near as can be determined, Joe Kennedy had laid the groundwork for mob involvement in obtaining votes through the assistance of key leaders of organized crime families. Joe supplied the money. The mob supplied the contacts and the organization, and they were responsible for the grassroots bribery." When the state of Illinois became pivotal, the elder Kennedy requested assistance from Chicago mobster Sam Giancana, according to his brother Chuck Giancana and nephew Sam in their book Double Cross, the explosive inside story of the mobster who controlled America. The help was provided. JFK won the state. But Joe, according to the authors, had promised Giancana that if Son John won, there would be no further trouble for James Hoffa or mobsters Giancana, Mickey Cohen, Santo Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello. In essence, according to Sam Giancana's brother and nephew, Joe promised Giancana the new administration would look the other way and leave these men alone. Former Justice Department prosecutor and House Select Committee on Assassinations Chief Counsel G. Robert Blakey confirmed that underworld figures had been involved in JFK's Illinois campaign, with money and infecting the political process with bribes and voting irregularities. The margin of victory was less than 9,000 votes, thanks to the Democratic machine led by Mayor Richard Daley. Apparently, Senator Everett Dirksen, Republican from Illinois, the GOP leader, called Deputy Director of the FBI, Cartha DeLoach, requesting an investigation. But when DeLoach turned the matter over to the Justice Department, there was no probe based on pressure from RFK, who was about to become Attorney General. In the minds of Giancana's brother and nephew, there was immediate shock when JFK appointed his brother Attorney General. This was confirmed by author Kitty Kelly's assertion that Bobby being Attorney General was the last thing that anyone in the mob thought would happen, triggering signs of betrayal, a nasty business within an underworld that had its own code of ethics and brand of loyalty connected with promises. Frank Regano, attorney for James Hoffa, Santo Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello, also had an opinion he expressed in Mob Lawyer. He recounted a conversation months after JFK's death when Giancana, who controlled the precinct captains in Chicago, joined Trafficante and him at a Florida restaurant for dinner. Regano said Giancana blustered in no uncertain terms that his organization won, or rather stole, the 1960 election for Kennedy by fixing votes for him in Cook County. Author's note: Special Prosecutor Morris Wexler's report in 1961 discovered irregularities involving substantial miscounts in and around Chicago, including unqualified voters, misread voting machines, and math mistakes. JFK won the state by 8,858 votes out of 4.7 million cast. On another occasion, Regano quoted Giancana, described by author Evan Thomas in his Robert Kennedy biography as one who had hung people on meat hooks, as saying, "That rat bastard son of a bitch. We broke our balls for him, JFK, and gave him the election, and he gets his brother Bobby to hound us to death." Sam's daughter, Antoinette Giancana, and co-author Thomas C. Renner wrote in their book Mafia Princess, growing up in Sam Giancana's family, "When Sam learned that Robert F. Kennedy had been appointed Attorney General, he felt it was a rabbit punch in the dark." Antoinette added that her father said, "Someday they're going to get their lunch. In other words, somebody is going to take after them and really destroy them, and it won't just be me. It's also going to be others that are going to lead to the Kennedy demise." Certainly, Sam Giancana had reason to offer this warning. Author Evan Thomas wrote in his biography, Robert Kennedy, His Life, RFK chose to embarrass Giancana with intense federal surveillance. Mafioso Bill Bonanno wrote in his book, Bound by Honor, A Mafioso's Story, that the appointment was the shock of the winter. If Kennedy had wanted to, he could not have sent a more alarming signal to our world. This reaction was based on Bonanno swearing that Joseph Kennedy, when asked before the election what Bobby's intended position would be in the new administration, had responded, "The old man specifically told us that if Jack was elected, he was going to make Bobby ambassador to Ireland or something like that." Bonanno also chronicled the friendship between his father Joe and Joe Kennedy, while noting that in the mid-1950s, Joe Kennedy had begged Joe Bonanno to assist with newly elected Senator John Kennedy's plans for the future. Bill Bonanno, who also noted Joe Kennedy's friendship with Frank Costello, wrote, "My father that day promised that he would do what he could to help Joe Kennedy when and if the time came. This was a pledge made out of friendship, but also out of something else. My father knew Joe Kennedy, knew enough about his past to feel confident that help offered would be returned. There was friendship, and a skeleton or two in the closet." Bill Bonanno also swore in his book that Joe Kennedy was warned during the fall of 1961 of impending trouble ahead if Bobby didn't forego his crusade against the mafia. Bonanno wrote, "We sent Smitty D'Angelo to Palm Beach to meet with Joe Kennedy and tell him about our concerns. He specifically told the old man that there were people in our world who felt betrayed, who had looked to him as a friend only to be disappointed. Kennedy told him not to worry." Joe Kennedy's response, according to Bonanno, was, "There's nothing to worry about. The boys, JFK and RFK, will be home with me over Christmas. Wait until after Christmas." Bonanno then noted that Christmas never came that year, since 1 week before the holidays, Joe suffered a massive stroke, leaving him incapacitated. This permits speculation as to whether Joe Kennedy might have ordered Bobby to back off his campaign to destroy the mafia. But by the fall of 1961, RFK had already attacked the mobsters with a vengeance, By deporting Marcello and charging him with racketeering, hitting Trafficante with tax evasion charges, hounding Giancana, and escalating his crusade to imprison Hoffa. This makes it difficult to believe that Joe Kennedy could have persuaded Bobby, headstrong as he was, to forgo his obsession to rid the world of these men, even if Joe had told him to do so. Regardless, the patriarch, who also was aware of how the underworld took care of their enemies, should have realized that the warning from Giancana's henchmen was real, and that if Bobby didn't back off, bad things could happen. No one knows for sure whether Bobby would have heeded his father's advice if it had been passed along, especially because, according to author Evan Thomas, Bobby had a deep respect for his father, tinged with fear. Regardless, as Thomas wrote, the mobsters continued to squeal that they had been double-crossed by the Kennedys, meaning that because Joe was warned and couldn't follow through due to his stroke, a chance to potentially fend off the president's assassination had been lost. When Thomas mentioned mobsters, it is not a stretch to believe that he intended the remark to refer to the prominent mobsters of the day, men such as Mickey Cohen, Santo Trafficante, Carlos Marcello, and Sam Giancana. These men believed they had been double-crossed by Joe Kennedy promising one thing, that they would be left alone if JFK was elected, or at the very least were given the impression by Joe that this would occur, and then doing another by appointing RFK, who had sworn to tear the mafia to pieces. This perceived betrayal had to have generated an atmosphere of hatred that would soon boil over into violence. The double cross by Joe Kennedy, which then extended to RFK's assault on the mafia, had been debated for years, even to the point where it is contested, especially by the Kennedy family, that underworld figures played a large part in JFK becoming president by ensuring he would win Illinois and West Virginia through their efforts to fix the vote during the 1960 election. It may be recalled that in the book Rose, author Charles Higham offered proof of mafia involvement by stating that based on his research, the real reason Rose never set foot in West Virginia was because Bobby invited a Las Vegas mobster to the state, where he was authorized to use criminal tactics in ensuring votes, a plan originated by Sam Giancana and approved by RFK. Regarding Rose's knowledge of this, recall that Higham wrote, "She must be protected from knowing this at all costs." That Bobby Kennedy actually invited a mobster to West Virginia may seem unlikely, but Higham's account about Rose being kept in the dark has mainly been overlooked over the years by those focused on the alleged double cross. One author who supplies confirming facts about Joe and Bobby's breaking their promise is distinguished scholar and author Dr. Larry J. Sabato. In his book, The Kennedy Half-Century, he wrote, "Many mafia kingpins loathed the Kennedys, mainly because RFK went after organized crime with a vengeance once he became Attorney General. He raised the number of mob convictions from 35 in 1960 to 288 in 1963. Sabato, based on credible primary sources, had dug deeper into Joe's dealings with Sam Giancana, writing, "Shortly before the 1960 election, Joseph Kennedy was said to have promised Chicago mafioso Sam Giancana access to the White House in return for intervening with another mobster, Frank Costello, who had threatened to kill Joe over a property dispute." The author added, "The elder Kennedy was said to have told Giancana, 'You help me now, Sam, and I'll see to it that you can sit in the goddamned Oval Office if you want. You'll have the president's ear.'" According to Sabato, Giancana agreed, and Joe was taken off Costello's hit list. Summing up Giancana's relationship with the elder Kennedy before the election, Sabato wrote, "Giancana apparently helped JFK by distributing the Kennedy patriarch's cash to buy endorsements and votes during the critical West Virginia primary election in May 1960. The author then mentioned Giancana's fellow mafia don Carlos Marcello, who was even angrier than Giancana after the double cross, and quoted House Select Committee on Assassinations G. Robert Blakey as believing that Marcello and Santo Trafficante, the mob don of southern Florida, were the brains behind the JFK murder. Yes, Joe Kennedy had taught Bobby everything he knew, and JFK ultimately paid the price for their actions. In the epilogue to Mob Lawyer, Frank Regano and Selwyn Robb wrote, "Within the close culture of the mafia, a boss can never tolerate even the appearance of an insult. The Kennedys, unaware of the primitive mindset of these amoral mobsters, had insulted the grotesque pride of Santo, Carlos, Sam Giancana, and other overlords. Joseph Kennedy had made a commitment of his sons, no further harassment of these men, and they had violated it." To those who question whether Bill Bonanno and the Giancana family are worthy of belief regarding their recollections, the stories they tell have a ring of truth to them based on Joe Kennedy's propensity to make promises and break them. Author Ted Schwartz wrote, "Joe's utilization of the mob was no different from the patron-client arrangement used in Sicily by men who formed the base of the American mafia. Joe had done favors for which repayment was expected. He called them in to help his son win the presidential election." The author then added, "Jack misunderstood this, or his father did not explain the rules. He seems to have made deals on his own, never realizing that each favor granted was a favor expected." If Schwartz is correct, not only Joe Kennedy, but Jack was beholden to the underworld for promises made. Perhaps this is why JFK was at first reluctant to appoint RFK as Attorney General. Perhaps he knew of the risk, but with his father pressing the issue and failing to take no for an answer, the president had no choice in the matter. Another indication that Joe Kennedy and his son Jack were playing with fire occurred during the inaugural celebration following JFK's election. Frank Sinatra, who had ingratiated himself with all of the Kennedys, including JFK's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, had been most instrumental in setting up the entertainment for the inaugural. Among those performing were Harry Belafonte, Nat King Cole, and Sinatra himself. In the February 2011 issue of Vanity Fair, an article by Todd S. Purdom titled "From This Day Forth" chronicled what the magazine called a movable, star-studded bash. Among the photographs presented was one depicting Sinatra sitting beside the new president, Sinatra smiling away. To indicate their close friendship, another photograph showed Sinatra lighting the president's cigarette. Barely a year later, JFK was scheduled to make a visit to Sinatra's compound in Palm Springs. Sinatra even went to the length of building, Purdom noted, a heliport to handle the landing of Marine One. But when J. Edgar Hoover told Bobby Kennedy that JFK and Sam Giancana were sharing the same girlfriend, Judith Campbell Exner, and that Sinatra had been receiving telephone calls from her, JFK abruptly canceled the visit, leaving Sinatra embarrassed over the slight. Purdom said Sinatra never spoke to Peter Lawford again, an indication of Sinatra's wrath, adding the famous singer to the list. The long list, including Hoffa, Trafficante, Marcello, and Cohen, who had long since lost any love for the new president and his brother Bobby. This was the same Mickey Cohen whose FBI file, secured through the Freedom of Information Act by this author, read, "Cohen had killed in the past and should be considered armed and dangerous." Of the snub, Tina Sinatra told author Carrie Beauchamp, "Dad was stunned when the administration began to prosecute the very people it had enlisted for help just the year before. He had gone to Sam Giancana out of friendship for Jack Kennedy and expected nothing back. What he did not expect was to be set up like a fool." Beauchamp added, "The rebuff of Sinatra sent reverberations deep into the mob, who had to wonder what was next." Joe Kennedy may have been guilty of many things in his life, including never letting his mob friends know he was a contact agent for the FBI, but double-crossing the mafia was a fatal mistake. One may only speculate on what Joe Kennedy's mindset was when he forced JFK to appoint Bobby Attorney General. Perhaps he had an ulterior motive, believing that with Bobby as the head of the Justice Department, no one would dare investigate irregularities during the presidential election in West Virginia, Illinois, or any other state. Or perhaps Joe, power-hungry at every turn, wanted two sons at the head of government. One was not enough. This explanation makes more sense when one considers further the context within which Joe ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Attorney General. There is no doubt that Joe had wanted to be president, to sit at the desk in the Oval Office, a dream of his throughout his adult life. But those chances had all but disappeared during his term as ambassador to England. As David Nassau wrote, Joe was perpetually out of step with everyone around him, and this included his views about Adolf Hitler's intentions and American isolationism. Describing Joe's downfall, Nassau wrote, he had sought to be an insider but refused to be a team player because Joe was convinced that he knew better than his superiors. As ambassador, he had had his priorities and he'd pursued them relentlessly, breaking rules and protocol whenever he thought it necessary.